Omaha Public Radio presents another lecture program from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We'll hear part three of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk will be given by Nikolai Roddy, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies in the Creighton University Department of Theology. His topic will be Ego as Exile, an Older Testament Perspective on Human Suffering. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 14, 2012, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of Creighton University, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Julie Fleming, chairman of the Creighton Department of Theology.
Dr. Roddy's field of expertise is the Hebrew Scriptures or the Old Testament, and his presentation tonight is called Ego as Exile, an Older Testament Perspective on Suffering. Thank you very much. Would you please disconnect all electronic devices for the remainder of the flight? And Dr. Roddy, we'll leave it to you.
Thank you, Dr. Fleming. I'd like to thank Dr. Wright and the Kenefick Chair Committee for inviting me to speak in this series, and to the Theology Department also for sponsoring, and thank you for the nice introduction, Dr. Fleming. I'd like to thank all of you for being here this evening on this Valentine's evening. And with that, we'll get started. As Dr. Fleming said, the title of the presentation is Ego as Exile, an Older Testament Perspective on Human Suffering. In the brief few minutes that we share this evening, I would like to suggest a particular way of reading the Hebrew Bible or Older Testament that permits insight into the cause and effects of an especially insidious and surreptitious aspect of personal human suffering, namely estrangement and alienation from one's truer self, others, and, at least perceptually, from God. This dis-ease plays out in a variety of ways, usually manifested in despair, the specific character of which, according to Søren Kierkegaard's character Anticlimacus in The Sickness Unto Death, is that it is unaware of being despair. The methodology will involve a canon critical reader response approach to a topic which grows out of a more comprehensive biblical theology project that explores the larger question of what it might mean ultimately to be human from a biblical perspective in contrast to what it means merely to be human. It may be difficult to imagine that a corpus of ancient texts brought together and edited at some 2,500 years ago and 7,000 miles away would offer anything of value for addressing what many would take to be a distinctively modern Western malaise, namely the suffering and despair associated with the problem of the ego self, especially given that the notion of the ego, along with individual and individualism, strictly speaking, do not actually exist in the social or literary worlds of the Bible. However, I would argue that the archetypal horror of estrangement from one's true place in the world lurks deep within the human psyche, as evidenced by much of the ancient world's surviving known literature, and that, mediated by the cognitive ability for authentic reflection on the causes of physical displacement, on the basis of careful examination of its cause, a roadmap for returning home may be drawn. For our purposes this evening, physical displacement, or exile, will serve as a metaphor for psychic dislocation, while the return home will speak to the process of recovering psychic or spiritual wholeness, attained through a process of scathingly critical self-examination of the causes of one's own alienation. Thus, while the compilers of the Bible found the fundamental human predicament of the Babylonian exile rooted in Israel's collective covenantal failure, our investigation focuses on the problem of the ego, classically and popularly defined as a function of the mind that manifests itself in a number of possible ways, having in common the centrality of the self, which together with the self may exhibit positive social attributes of self-assurance, self-confidence, and positive self-image, but also socially less favorable displays of narcissism, arrogance, deep-seated feelings of inadequacy, alienation, isolation, and so on. Because I'm a theologian and not a psychologist or social psychologist, the psychic or spiritual wholeness we seek does not look to Alport, Ash, or Maslow, but toward a model of ultimate humanity informed by the patristic theological perspective as it is played out in the Byzantine and Eastern Orthodox Christian tradition. Such a view holds that the human being is a priori good because it has a good cause, complete because it lacks nothing essential in itself, purposeful because it is by nature oriented toward God, and relational because it participates in created nature with other human beings in a cosmos permeated by divine energies, better known in the West as grace. In order to be found worthy of science, however, we will limit ourselves to complete, purposive, and relational, or social, if you will, and lay aside the mystical. So with all of the necessary introductory remarks out of the way, let's set the stage by turning to the Bible's foundational stories, which call to mind the theme of exile and alienation. The Lord God drove out the man, and at the east of the Garden of Eden he placed the cherubim and a sword flaming and turning to guard the way to the tree of life. Genesis 3, verses 22 and 24. And the Lord said to Cain, "What have you done? Listen, your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When you till the ground, it will no longer yield you its strength. You will be a fugitive and a wanderer upon the earth." Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord and settled in the land of Nod, east of Eden. Genesis 4, 16. What might it mean that the first two episodes of the Bible conclude with the earliest human beings suffering displacement and alienation from their rooted place in the world and the presence of the God who brought them into existence and planted them in that place? Might it be a reflection of the storyteller's take on the human condition, that certain human actions invariably lead one into exile from one's place of origin? Compiled in response to the destruction of Jerusalem's palace temple complex and related deportations, the Bible not only resonates with themes of destruction and exile, but carries within it its own reasons for how and why displacement occurs, knowledge necessary for entertaining any hope for a return. Not concerned to write history as we expect it to be written, the writers attribute Israel's exile not to the Babylonians, but ultimately to their own failures as a people before God. Similarly, in seeking the etiology of personal alienation and dis-ease from a biblical perspective, we begin with the view of the human person in the familiar words of Genesis 1. And God said, "Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness." So God created humankind in his image. In the image of God he created them. Male and female he created them. God blessed them, and God said, "Be fruitful and multiply, and fill the earth and subdue it, and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the air and over every living thing that moves upon the earth." A vast amount of scholarly and devotional literature has been written about what being created in the image of God might mean. Scholars have taken note of the royal imagery present in the language of dominion and have built upon this putative status a bold anthropocentric understanding of creation, not all of which has been necessarily positive. But even negative appraisals of humanity's self-understanding of its place in the world tend to be highly anthropocentric, pervading theological discourse to the degree that it is difficult to imagine anyone ascribing any sort of diminished importance to human beings. But this road not taken may be an avenue worthy of exploration. For there is yet another way, a less obvious option, for thinking about what being created in the image of God might mean. Despite royal terminology and the use of crowning and dominion, human beings are nevertheless inextricably rooted in the created order. With Genesis 1 in mind, the composer of Psalm 8 asks the question, "Ma'anosh, what is humanity, that you are mindful of it?" and situates human beings, "Me'at me'Elohim," a little lower than God, or a little lower than the gods, is also an acceptable translation. The question remains open and unanswered in the psalm, and framed at beginning and end with the words, "O Lord, our King, how majestic is your name in all the earth," making it clear that the question of whatever it means to be human can only be answered within the framework of God's majesty and sovereignty over the domain of human being, or for non-theists, within the majestic and fathomless cosmos. From a biblical perspective, part of what it may mean ultimately to be human is to remain mindful of humanity's narrow place, rooted in creation, along with the responsibility for maintaining it, yet lower than God. One well might say that from a biblical perspective, one of the most serious implications of being created in the image of God is precisely that one is not God. So who is the God of the Bible that human beings are not? Moses meets him atop his very own mountain where he even learns his name. Moses said to God, "If I come to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your ancestors has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What's his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am." He said further, "Thus you shall say to the Israelites, 'I am has sent me to you.' This is my name forever, and this my title for all generations." The divine name, the Tetragrammaton, represented in English Bibles by the word Lord in all capital letters, derives from an old form of the Hebrew verb to be, which raises several intriguing possibilities for thinking about the nature of supreme being. But one should keep in mind that ontological distinctions are products of later Hellenized theological and philosophical thinking, all but irrelevant for examining these texts within their original ancient Hebrew contexts. In the narrative world of the Bible, the I Am is but some superhuman being ruling from a heavenly court located high above the blue dome of the firmament, whose sole identifiable characteristic is that this deity is a god of action. Thus, in the Garden of Eden story, we see the Most High as an anthropomorphized planter of trees, a potter fashioning the first human beings from clay, a tailor sewing leather garments for his exiled creatures. But this being is also supremely transcendent and powerful and unique in every respect, doing whatever he wills because he can, bringing down upon the earth both fire and rain. A unique being who behaves in a unique manner through his prophets to raise up the lowly and the dead, to topple kings and destroy entire nations. In sum, the biblical God does what he wills for his own purposes because he can. Theologically speaking, this is about as apophatic as it gets, for it is precisely this attribute of unrestrained uniqueness that human beings are not permitted. This God-not God dichotomy must be considered when thinking about what creation in the image of God means, for as the prophet Isaiah says, "Remember the former things of old, for I am God and there is no other. I am God and there is no one like me." Thus the distinction, "I am God and you're not," is present from the very start, in Genesis 1 and in the primordial garden, where the only apparent difference between uncreated deity and created human beings is that the latter possesses knowledge of good and evil. Human beings enjoy paradise and tend to its care. They eat of the tree of life and so may live for as long as they have access to it, but they find themselves evicted from never-ending life, exiled instead to a life of toil and suffering and eventually death. Resonating so viscerally with the human condition and all the fears and anxieties that accompany it, it is no wonder that the so-called fall of humankind has been interpreted through Western Christian art and literature more than any other event of the Older Testament. In fact, our impressions of the story as it's come down to us, especially as interpreted through such literary works as Milton's Paradise Lost and powerful graphic depictions by artists like Masaccio di San Giovanni, whose expulsion is a personal favorite of mine, are so familiar to us that it is almost impossible to read the biblical text afresh in any other way. But there is one aspect of the story that gets overlooked, which likely would not have been lost on the ancient audience. As much as I would like, I simply don't have time to go into all the ways poor Eve has been framed by later interpreters. If this subject is of particular interest to you, I would encourage you to read Carol Meyer's Discovering Eve, Ancient Israelite Women in Context, from which I've learned a great deal. Readers should note that the story of Eden is couched in the language of fertility and agriculture, and that one does not find expected theological words like sin or fall. You will recall that God plants two beautiful trees in the middle of the garden, of which the first humans may eat from only one, namely the tree of life. They are not permitted to eat the fruit of the other tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Beset by the clever serpent, the first woman is presented with the question, "Shall you not eat from any tree of the garden?" To which she replies, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden. But God said, 'You shall not eat of the fruit of the tree that is in the middle of the garden, nor shall you touch it, or you shall die.'" Notice that the tree of life is not described at all, but the fateful tree of the knowledge of good and evil is said to appear good for food and a delight to the eyes and to be desired to make one wise. By the way, can you imagine any other human society having fully 50% of its population involved in the attempt to attain wisdom, none of which is male? The serpent eggs her on, and at least for the short term, appears to be telling the truth when he tells her, "You shall not die, for God knows that when you eat of it, your eyes will be opened, and you will be like God, knowing good and evil, and living forever," we must add. For the combined fruit of these two trees impart properties possessed naturally by the Supreme Being. The garden dwellers may eat the fruit of one tree or the other, but are not permitted to have both, lest they become like God or as gods. This is backed up by the fact that at the end of the story, the angel with the flaming sword is placed there to guard the tree of life, to prevent the man from reaching out his hand, to take also from the tree of life and eat and live forever. Thus, the Lord God thwarts the ability of human beings to become like himself by expelling them from his garden, guarding his entrance with a flaming sword, thereby jealously ensuring his unique status for all generations, serving to demonstrate that the Lord is God, remember, I am, and humans are not. Gods, that is. The motif of human beings attempting to set themselves up as gods, only to be restored to their rightful place in the created order, continues throughout much of the Hebrew Bible. It is most explicit in the Babel story, in which the humans attempt to build a tower into the heavens, only to be thwarted by God, who, according to the text, is concerned that there would now be no limit to the scope of human ambition. But it is implicit each time a biblical character does what he, less commonly she, does what he wants at the expense of others, simply because he thinks he is unique and therefore can. With that, we leave the foundational myths of the Bible's primeval narrative and enter into the ancestral narratives in the former prophets, where one sees how blurring the God-not God or the I am-you're-not dichotomy may lead to estrangement and alienation. Only someone who has not actually read the Bible could utter the naive, oft-heard, and ludicrous assertion that biblical characters somehow exist as moral exemplars for people of faith to emulate. When on the contrary, these figures exhibit a wide array of human behaviors that any society would find offensive. Here one finds a long list of unsavory human behaviors, including murder, incest, rape, and other forms of assorted violence. Even characters with some moral appeal, such as Abraham, the matriarchs, Joseph, Tamar, and Josiah, still behave in questionable ways which cannot be shrugged off as culturally specific behaviors that would have been deemed acceptable in their own distant place and time. For centuries, biblical exegetes have sought to explain away or otherwise soften the scandalous actions of the Bible's main characters, a long list of scoundrels and ne'er-do-wells that include Jacob, Judah, David, Solomon, and several others. What was the interest in preserving such scandalous stories about Israel's leading figures throughout the Law and the Prophets? Well, let's take a look at a couple of examples. In the so-called David and Bathsheba story, David's behavior is, by any moral standard, nothing short of heinous. From a biblical perspective, he manages to break several of the Ten Commandments in a single afternoon. This scathing episode in the chronicle of Israel's most famous king, so scandalous that the chronicler chose to omit it from his court cycle, stands in stark contrast to what one would expect of a divinely appointed Israelite monarch. Nevertheless, the omniscient narrator wastes no time in setting the scenes deftly involving the reader in the poignant irony that at the time of the year when the kings of other nations go out to battle with their troops, David remained back in Jerusalem. We're not concerned with the historicity of the Clinton-esque scandal about to ensue, only that in the narrative world of the Bible, David is not where he ought to be, given Israel's initial justification for requesting a king in the first place, namely, so that it could be like other nations. The reader is then borne swiftly through a rapid sequence of events. David looks down from the palace and sees Bathsheba bathing on a roof. He sends for her. They have intercourse and she becomes pregnant. Fearing the scandal, David summons Bathsheba's husband, Uriah the Hittite, from the battlefield, whereupon the king entertains the warrior and tries to persuade him to spend some quality time at home. Uriah resists the king's urging and remains at the palace entrance out of a sense of loyalty for his fellows on the field of battle. David intensifies his efforts to have Uriah go home by plying him with wine. But out of solidarity with his fellow soldiers on the field, Uriah still refuses to go home, whereupon David sends the soldier back to the front with a note ordering his military commander to place the unfortunate warrior at the forefront of battle and withdraw that he may be killed. For a brief time, David appears to have succeeded. For although David forfeits the battle, Uriah is out of the picture, and the king gains yet another wife. It is unfortunate that the polarity of character oppositions between David and Uriah is altogether missed when one reads the text under the influence of modern Western cultural standards and expectations, for which Uriah becomes a mere casualty of power, a pawn sacrificed at the whim of the king. Perhaps this is why the story is still referred to in our culture as the David and Bathsheba story instead of the David and Uriah story. But laying aside these cultural influences restores the symmetry of the narrative's polar irony, thus revealing the central theme of the story, namely that of loyalty, disloyalty to Israel and Israel's God. In the absence of a stated motive, the plot suggests that David does what he does simply because he believes he can. And why not? As Mel Brooks' character Louis XIV exclaims in History of the World Part 2, everybody, it's good to be the king, right? Uriah the Hittite, on the other hand, behaves quite differently. The reader is not informed whether Uriah is being duped by David or is fully cognizant of the situation and engaging the king in some sort of psychological game of chess. Thus, as with Bathsheba, Uriah can be viewed either as hapless victim or clever schemer. But in contrast to David, Uriah clearly demonstrates loyalty to the troops, to Israel, and thus to Israel's true king, qualities altogether lacking in David. Uriah seems naturally to grasp this. His king does not. The fact that expectations and actions between these two characters have been reversed gives the story a didactic moral dimension that contributes to its enduring dynamism. Like the David and Uriah episode, the story of Judah and Tamar juxtaposes the actions of an Israelite leader with those of a marginal character. The story opens with Judah moving away from his brothers, whereupon he marries the daughter of a Canaanite and sires three sons by her. And when Judah's eldest son, Er, is grown, Judah secures Tamar as a wife for him. But without offering any explanation, the text asserts that Er was wicked in the eyes of the Lord, so God killed him. Following the custom prescribed by the Deuteronomistic law code, Judah instructs Onan, his second son, to go into Tamar's tent to perform the duty of a brother-in-law by impregnating her. Onan visits her repeatedly, but instead of impregnating her, he practices coitus interruptus, spilling his seed upon the ground, to state it biblically. For this, the writer asserts, Onan was wicked in the eyes of the Lord, so God killed him. Perhaps fearing that Tamar must be accursed or some sort of witch, Judah sends her back to her father's house, under the pretense that Shelah, his youngest son, had not yet attained puberty. When Judah withholds Shelah even after he has come of age, Tamar seizes an opportunity to take matters into her own hands. Following the death of her mother-in-law and observance of the customary period of mourning, Judah and his friend Hira the Adullamite go up to Timnah to visit the sheep shearers. Hearing of this, Tamar removes her widow's garments, and disguising herself as a prostitute, stations herself near the entrance to Enaim on the road to Timnah. When Judah passes by and sees the veiled woman, he crosses the road to solicit her, not recognizing that she is his daughter-in-law. As part of her plan, and already knowing what sort of man Judah has shown himself to be, Tamar demands collateral for his promise to send her a kid from the flock as a payment for sex. When asked what sort of pledge would satisfy her, Tamar replies, "Your signet, and your cord, and the staff that's in your hand." Robert Alter's take on this compares this to something very important, like his driver's license and a major credit card and perhaps the keys to his Lexus. These are symbols of personal identity and authority. And to this, Judah naively agrees. And when Judah sends Hira back to Enaim with a kid from the flock in order to redeem his collateral, Tamar is nowhere to be found. Judah then resigns himself to the loss of his property lest his actions be found out and he face a loss of honor. About 3 months later, Judah is informed that his daughter-in-law had played the whore and as a result had become pregnant, to which the patriarch exclaims, "Bring her out and let her be burned." As Tamar is brought out, she asks Judah to identify the articles she had taken from him as collateral, upon which he replies, "She is more in the right than I, since I did not give her to my son Shelah. Tamar uses knowledge and cunning to overcome the powerlessness that kept her from upholding the divine and social law in service to her dead husband. One imagines that any woman in Tamar's place would have felt humiliated and disgusted by Onan's actions, as well as in having to seduce and sleep with someone as despicable as Judah. Like Uriah the Hittite, Tamar is a character whose ethnic origins are ambiguous, whose recourse to power seems ostensibly limited in light of her lower social status, and yet who demonstrates far greater awareness concerning what it means to uphold the laws of God than the highest-ranking Israelite on the scene. As in the story of David and Uriah, we see here the juxtaposition of the actions of two contrasting characters. On the one hand, a leading Israelite leader, for whom reader expectations run high. On the other, a character of lower social status, and thus less recourse to more obvious channels of power. Like David, Judah does what he wants to do at another's expense because he believes he can. Like David, Judah wishes to avoid public shame. Having argued that being created in the image of God means that one is not God, that is, not a law to oneself, it is possible now to state what that might mean in positive terms. The dominant image of God in the Bible is as a King of Kings, a Lord of Lords, whose primary characteristic is chesed, or steadfast loving kindness, manifested in the twinned attributes of mishpat v'tzedekah, justice and righteousness. Each of these terms has a wide range of meaning. When the words are paired, as they often are in the Bible, especially in the book of Isaiah, they can form what is known as a hendiadys, a pairing of nouns that opens up a semantic range beyond anything the terms might have on their own. The fact that God has established justice and judges with righteousness from his throne demands that kings and judges of the earth are to do likewise, as Psalm 72 asserts, "Give the king your justice, O God, and your righteousness to a king's son. May he judge your people with righteousness and your poor with justice." By extension, the twinned pairing of justice and righteousness is expected of any person in a position of responsibility. The implications of mishpat v'tzedekah cannot be overstated in light of our search for a genuine biblical anthropology and a way home. The pairing of terms not only describes the Bible's portrait of God, but also helps delimit the rightful place of human beings in the cosmos, standing at the pinnacle of creation, bearing the image of God, yet not seeking to be as a God, to exist as a law to oneself at the expense of others. These twinned attributes must be held in balance. For righteousness that lacks justice easily becomes self-righteousness, and justice without righteousness lacks mercy. We've already seen the latter in David's administration of mishpat without tzedakah. The former, the sin of self-righteousness, may be seen in the characters of Job and the prophet Jonah. From the patristic period onward, the church has celebrated Job as a patient and suffering righteous one, and therefore an obvious harbinger of Christ, accounting for why the Orthodox Church begins every Holy Week with readings from the book of Job. But we see that even Job is not exempt from the sin of confusing the God-not-God dichotomy. In Nietzsche, the protagonist Job is beset by calamities precipitated by Hasatan, or the accuser, a heavenly being whose job it is to walk to and fro upon the earth, testing the motives and methods of human beings. Attempting to test the assertion that Job loves God only because God has blessed him so richly, the accuser is permitted to test his fidelity by taking everything away from him. But even though Job loses his 10 children and all of his great wealth, he remains true blue, even withstanding his wife's chiding to curse God and die. As Job sits amid the rubble in his suffering and his loss, he is visited by 3 friends, seemingly wise and knowing men, who argue one after another that Job's sin against God must indeed have been grievously wicked in order to have been visited by such devastating recompense. Job resists their charges, asserting that he's done nothing to deserve such misery, but his 3 friends each in turn point out with simple logic that because God requites good with good and evil with evil, ipso facto, Job must have sinned big time. As Job continues asserting his innocence, the ground of his argument begins to shift and crumble beneath him as his protests begin to sound more like boasts. "Oh, that I had one to hear me! Here is my signature. Let the Almighty answer me. Oh, that I had the indictment written by my adversary. Surely I would carry it on my shoulder. I would bind it on me like a crown. I would give him an account of all my steps. Like a prince, I would approach him. Job 31, 35 through 37. This is followed by a prose portion, which makes clear the import of Job's words, stating that his three friends ceased responding to Job because, quote, he became righteous in his own eyes, end quote. A later redactor also takes the opportunity to introduce a mysterious fourth visitor into the discourse. Elihu claims to be a young man dissatisfied with the way the three have been responding to Job's apparent self-righteousness and confronts Job for his sin against God. The wise who hear me will say, says Elihu, Job speaks without knowledge. His words are without insight. Would that Job were tried to the limit, because his answers are those of the wicked. For he adds rebellion to his sin. He claps his hands among us and multiplies his words against God. Do you think this to be just when you say, I am in the right before God? Once Elihu has reframed the picture of the righteous Job to the self-righteous Job, who opens his mouth in empty talk and multiplies words without knowledge, the voice of the Lord then begins speaking to Job from the whirlwind. Stanza after stanza, the Creator God illustrates his power and majesty until Job finally gets it. In a moment of clarity, reminiscent of the stories of David and Judah, David's confronted by Nathan. He gets it with a parable. Judah gets it when he's confronted with his possessions. Job understands that he is presumed to speak at length about things he knows nothing about. Things too wonderful for me, he says. I had heard of you by the hearing of my ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore, I humble myself and repent in dust and ashes. The point here is the fine line separating authentic, natural righteousness that is not dependent upon human speech, and the surreptitious sin of self-righteousness revealing, according to Elihu, a lack of insight and a multiplication of words. The story of Jonah is also about presumption and overstepping boundaries of human regard and respect for the sovereignty of God. Time does not permit a retelling of this story, but the bottom line is that Jonah becomes angry with God because through him God has offered salvation to the Assyrians, and what is more, they accepted it, even down to their many animals. Thus, the question of what it might mean ultimately to be human may have something to do with the striving for authenticity in oneself while acknowledging and participating in engaged relationships with others. Life as dialogically relational, as Martin Buber asserts in I and Thou, in which the other is not only acknowledged with all the dignity duly accorded a person, but embraced at once in a kind of shared subjectivity, in other words, as a thou. From a biblical perspective, behaving uniquely in the manner of a God, that is, doing what one wants because one can, even if at the expense of others, results in exile and alienation. Overcoming the despair that does not know it is despair requires an aha moment, such as we see with David when confronted by Nathan, in Judah and in Job. On the other hand, living in a world of competing gods, vying for power and advantage, similar perhaps to what one finds in the Babylonian Enuma Elish, is to experience monstrosity and chaos. It brings about an unnatural condition in which human beings are not truly themselves, that is, in the sense of being complete, purposive, and relational. And the poor and the marginalized fall in danger of being trampled underfoot or altogether stamped out, even while serving the purposes of those who exploit them and regard them as means to an end. From the biblical perspective, being created in the image of God means that one is not God, but a creature endowed with the natural potential to bear the imprint of the sovereign Creator in displaying hesed, steadfast loving kindness, manifested in the forms of the twinned attributes of justice and righteousness, carried out at all levels of human responsibility. I have so many other stories to tell you that illustrate people at home, that is, experiencing psychic wholeness and fulfilling, albeit imperfectly, their intended natures as complete, purposive, and relational. The love between David and Jonathan, for example, the love between Naomi and her foreign daughter-in-law, Ruth, the love between Jacob and Rachel, and the reconciliation with his estranged brother Esau, whom he had deceived and sorely wronged. It seems appropriate that we should end this Valentine's Day calling to mind such stories, for truly love is the only real miracle. Thank you.
That was really provocative and interesting. Thank you, Dr. Roddy. We have a few minutes here for any questions or comments about this presentation. I invite you to raise your hand.
You used the phrase several times from a biblical perspective, as if there were one biblical perspective. But however many, is it 60-some books of the Old Testament, that sounds like there might be more than one perspective.
Yeah, there clearly are. And in fact, I was planning my next book, which is to retell the David and Bathsheba story, David Uriah's story, four different ways. There are lots of gaps in the narrative. Yeah. But what I didn't have time to explain is this greater project really focuses on the time, the first stage when we have Bible as Bible, which would be in my opinion, in the period of the exile, when these prophetically influenced priestly scribes suddenly realized that, you know, they had come to the end of their history with the destruction of Jerusalem's palace temple complex, and started collecting and selectively editing a bunch of texts that are dissonant. That, you know, counter each other. So you're right. There is no monolithic biblical perspective, but it is a biblical perspective, and it is a particular interpretation, and that's what I like about this setting. You know, it gives us an opportunity to be a little experimental and to dip into fields that, you know, aren't necessarily our own. You know, having my colleague Lee Budesheim here, Dr. Budesheim from psychology department, you know, could be a little daunting when I'm talking about things like ego. But he's very kind.
I was just very struck with the fact that when you parse those stories, which we're used to reading in very different ways, that you really read them all as, you know, stories about what it means to the difference between being God and not God, that human beings are, in fact, not God, and that when we fool ourselves to think we are, the results are disastrous. So... just a very different, because usually in theology, the idea of being created in the image and likeness of God has a very different cast to it than what you're saying.
Very lofty and very anthropocentric.
Yes, it is. Very.
But, you know, I often tell my students, I tell them every semester when we get to the Psalms, and I know you've heard me say this too before, Dr. Wright, if you get up in the morning first thing and go over to the window facing the east and stand and recite aloud Psalm 104, you cannot possibly have a bad day or your money back. And, of course, I'm only saying that half tongue in cheek. The point is, if you do read Psalm 104, pay attention to what you're reading, listen to it, you realize suddenly that we're not that big a deal in the grand scheme of things in creation. We make ourselves that big a deal. We demand certain things. We expect certain things. It's all about us. You know, we're driving down the interstate, and everybody that's driving slower than us is an idiot, and everybody driving faster than us is a maniac, you know. But it puts things in perspective to know that to know that we don't have to be responsible for the ordering and the ongoing maintenance of the world. We need to take care of the 50-foot radius around us and display hesed, steadfast loving kindness, and have it manifest itself in action. This twinned attributes of justice and righteousness that, as I said, really need to exist together.
Well, I too kind of appreciated that I'm God, you're not kind of dichotomy. And as a psychologist, I can't speak to the theology of it. But it strikes me as I listen to you talk about it, there seems to be a constant human thirst for knowledge, quest for knowledge. And so... when do you see that being healthy, appropriate, and what are the signs, in your opinion, of that kind of quest becoming maladaptive, diseased? What language you want to use there?
Yeah, thanks for your question. It raises some other ideas and thoughts. It's not so much about, I mean, the quest for knowledge should be unlimited. I mean, we're endowed with that thirst and that quest to know God fully, to know ultimate reality, if you will, more fully, beyond our perspectives, that sort of thing. What it boils down to and what makes the difference, because I don't want to be, I'm always kind of afraid I'm going to be misunderstood here, that somehow being unique is, you know, having our, you know, being an individual, all that stuff is somehow a bad thing. I'm not saying that at all. I mean, there are incredible individuals who gave their lives for other people, and, you know, so it's not about being an individual or not an individual, even though that term's a little alien to the ancient world of the Bible. It's what you do vis-a-vis the people around you. And this is where I brought in kind of my Orthodox background, the fact that that we share created order. You know, the West, kind of, I think with the rise of nominalism, William of Ockham and that sort of thing, you know, things became discrete. Individuals became discrete. It paved the way for Protestant Reformation and other kinds of ideas and philosophical notions. But the Eastern Church, the Eastern milieu, has always kind of maintained that idea that we do participate in a created human nature. The interesting thing is the West, people in the West still talk about human nature, you know, even though philosophically they disavow that there is such a thing. So, but it's the relational aspect of it. If you act as an individual, that's great. If you it would be a good critique of you know some of the candidates we have running for president right now. You know, we live in a country where you can, you know, amass great wealth and live the kind of life that you want to live. But at some point, when there's a line that gets crossed, when suddenly it becomes on the backs of other people who are then, not allowed to go beyond that because of the actions, because of your continuous quest for what it is that you want as an individual. So I think we need to be a little bit more sensitive about how we are with one another. And again, that can only be limited to the 50-foot radius around me. I'd love to save the world, but I found out that I can't. I can just, you know, take care of myself and those that I associate with and hope to make some influence that way.
So only God can go ahead and be God and do
exactly
what God wants.
Exactly. Okay. And that's such a liberating thing.
Yeah, Nicola, I'd just like to ask you, you referred to the role of the outsider as the, I had never really thought about Uriah being a Hittite before, what the significance of that would be, that it is people who are not what one would expect that exemplify the behavior in the cases that you cited. And I wonder, could you tie that at all to the story of Abraham, who is called out of where he lives and becomes an exile, that is a person without the kind of stat. What do you think the significance of that is in the self-understanding?
Oh, I think absolutely there's a connection there. Abraham is a great example because he's not a prophet, he's not a king, he's called a prophet in one passage, but I mean, you know, generally speaking, he doesn't have this high office, leadership, anything. He's just an average Joe or an average Abraham called out of Ur of the Chaldees. Why? Because God chose him, who responded on faith. And really, I mean, Abraham is one of these people that I alluded to in the talk that, you know, he's not perfect, but if there's a character worthy of emulation, a single character, visible character worthy of emulation, I'd be okay with Abraham, you know, he responding on faith. And it becomes a tremendous symbol for the exiles, too, who are in Babylon, who are in near Ur of the Chaldees, which is, you know, why the Abraham story gets appended with, you know, that becomes his ultimate origin rather than Haran in the front, so that the, or up in Syria, so that the exiles can identify with him and respond on faith and be brought back to the land. So Abraham is a good example of that. But he's not as invisible as Uriah the Hittite, who, by the way, is not a foreigner. I mean, he has a Yahwistic theophoric name, Uriah, but he has this ethnic identity marker. Tamar, on the other hand, Tamar means date palm. It's a Hebrew name. But the fact that Judah's living with the Canaanites, you know, you have this ambiguity. She's almost certainly Canaanite, you know, foreign. But it just adds to the persona that these aren't people we expect to know what it might mean to uphold the laws of Israel and Israel's God, or to demonstrate loyalty and these kinds of things. The leaders, the people in person in offices of responsibility, fail miserably, and it's these invisible heroes, these marginalized heroes, that one has to look for, and would be safe in emulating.
I'm struck with just thinking a little closer in time to about the 4th century, how that theme plays itself out in a whole monastic sort of desert literature in which what scholars call harlots of the desert, become the, as it were, the critique of the pride of monks who think they, you know, have all of the, have it all together because they're fasting and they're praying continually and they're great spiritual athletes. And the, this whole genre of literature of these, you know, women who in the eyes of the world are, you know, the least of the least, and, you know, we shouldn't pay any attention to them. And they have these extraordinary conversion experiences and they become these amazing, you know, ascetics. And they, and basically the stories are about, you know, so you thought you were God, you know, well, God did this to people you would never expect. And it's not that they did it, but that God touches them and graces them and they become transformed. So I wonder if it's the same sort of literary piece there.
Yeah, I mean, there are definitely some parallels because, you know, we the hard part of it on the individual or on the personal level is this constant need to critique oneself. Institutions have to do that too, whether they be monastic, whether they be hierarchical in the church. I mean, there has to be a critical, you know, self-reflection, self-examination in order to kind of keep that honesty. And sometimes it takes someone from the outside. You know, I'm reminded of a monk called Basil, who, by the way, St. Basil in Red Square is named after, not named after Basil the Great, as most people think, but named after a simple monk who would sit on the steps of the church during Lent, watching the Russian Orthodox people go to church in their troikas at Easter, and he would be sitting there eating a kobasa, a sausage, and calling them all kinds of names and it's the tradition known as a fool for Christ's sake. And so you've got this this kind of aha moment, even for institutions sometimes. It would be nice if we could all just police ourselves so that we wouldn't have to have these aha moments, but we all need them at some point in our lives. I know I've had my share. I will still continue to need my aha moments.
What you just said about the outsider in the Old Testament reminded me of course, the parable of the so-called Good Samaritan in the New Testament.
Oh, sure. Excellent.
Because from the point of view of the Jews listening to that story, a heretic was being lifted up as the example to be followed.
Yeah. Excellent point. Absolutely. It ties into this this whole way of looking at things.
Well, I really thank you very much for a provocative and interesting talk. Thank you, Dr. Roddy. And happy Valentine's Day to all of you.
Yes,
thank
happy
you.
Happy Valentine's Day. Thank you.
You've been listening to a lecture from Creighton University on Noon Forum. We've heard the third of a three-part presentation entitled Human Misery in Today's World, co-sponsored by the Creighton Department of Theology and the John C. Kenefick Chair in the Humanities. Today's talk was given by Nikolai Roddy, Associate Professor of Old Testament Studies in the Creighton University Department of Theology. His topic was Ego as Exile, an Older Testament Perspective on Human Suffering. This program was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Tuesday evening, February 14, 2012, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Cindy Workman, Associate Director of Public Relations at Creighton University, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 200 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.